Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between. On this Gearing Up show, we're joined by David Dicker, the man behind Roden Cars, who are building some frankly insane road legal cars, as well as an F1 car that is faster than the current Grand Prix cars. He's built himself a multi-million dollar empire and he's here to chat all about it and his F1 aspirations. Thanks for listening. If you like it, please do leave us a review. It really helps us to get bigger, and enjoy.
Welcome to the latest episode of our Gearing Up series, where we focus on unsung heroes of motorsport or those within the industry that should have a spotlight shone on them for one reason or another. However, before I introduce today's guest, I have to head over to Essex to join my esteemed colleague who no longer has a nasty lockdown haircut but a perfectly cut barnet that any local £15 barber would be proud to call their own. Yes, it's the man that has more motorsport knowledge in his little finger than a veritable paddock of motorsport aficionados. It's the mighty, ladies and gentlemen, Harry Benjamin. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Tim. And I really don't pay you for these introductions, but every week they just get better and better. I was actually saying today how I actually have to go back to the barber, I think. It's getting a bit big now. So
yeah, the bouffon is growing.
Now that we're allowed to. I am all good. It's difficult to really update things because, you know, it's still a lockdown, really. And
yeah.
It's just difficult. I did have my first trip on the tube and I went into London town, the big smoke.
Was the tube completely deserted?
It wasn't completely deserted. There was quite a few people on there, but I mean, I didn't go during rush hour, but also obviously I had to wear my mask, which was an intriguing.
Yes.
And it was very hot as well. And that wasn't so pleasant, but that was doable. But I had my first sort of meeting in town and I had to have my whole temperature taken.
Yeah, a whole
new world, really.
It's that horrible phrase, the new normal, isn't it?
But it's how's the new normal been for you?
It's been fine. I mean, it's a bit weird, isn't it? It feels a bit like we're going backwards, which is slightly worrying. So I'm hoping that everything straightens out. I mean, it's good to have the racing back on TV, so that's a bonus. And we've obviously just had one of the Silverstone races.
About 40 laps of boring and then three laps of
carnage, yeah, which was good to watch. And obviously that was on Channel 4, which is a bonus for me without Sky Sports. So I managed to actually watch a race from start to finish on Freeview. But listen, shall I introduce today's guest?
Yeah, let's do it.
So our Gearing Up episodes are all about interesting folks in our beloved sport. And today we have a cracker. David Dicker could well take the prize as our most interesting guest so far. A man who admits he hated school, didn't get a degree, but found himself making a fortune through computers entirely self-taught. His company, Dicker Data, has turned over billions of dollars, but it's his latest venture that inspired us to reach out. One of his latest and greatest exploits is building a single-seater racing car that aims to be faster than an F1 car, and he's doing it through his own company, Rodin Cars. He's developing the cars on his own test track. Yes, he has a test track at his own office in New Zealand, and he's recently partnered with W Series champion Jamie Chadwick to cement his place in motorsport and increase brand awareness and utilize her skills as a development driver as he and his team create the ultimate track car. But there are also plans afoot for a frankly insane road legal car. It's a pleasure to have him here. David Dicker, welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
Yeah, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Indeed, David. You're in New Zealand at the moment, are you? So, I mean, we were just talking about it there and we can't get away from it, really. What's the situation like out in New Zealand? Because actually, we spoke to Brendan Hartley not long ago, who was based in New Zealand, and lockdown happened pretty early on there. And it seems that New Zealand's probably one of the better places to be right now.
Well, it's okay if you want to be stuck here.
But yeah.
I came back here from the first challenge round of this season, and they locked the joint down about 3 days later, and I've been stuck here ever since. The problem I've got is that, well, I couldn't even get out for the first couple of months. I could fly out now, but the issue is that you've got to spend 14 days basically in prison on the way back. And that makes it exceptionally difficult to basically do any business outside of New Zealand. The country's completely isolated.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one. So, well, back when the world was normal, where do you tend to spend most of your time?
Well, I actually live in Dubai, so I'd spend some time. Then I got a house in Italy, and I do Ferrari Challenge, and I was going to do Europe and Asia Pacific this year. So it was going to be a pretty busy schedule.
Whereabouts in Dubai have you got your place?
It's on the Palm.
Very nice, very nice. I spent 3 years living in Dubai, and it's a lovely place to live. Bloody hot during the summer months, but if you can tolerate that, you're okay. Do you tend to split your time between Dubai, New Zealand and Australia?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't spend that much time in Australia. I don't really need to. And obviously with the project we've got here in New Zealand, having to spend, I've been here for 5 months. I mean, it helps the project, just doesn't help me.
Yeah. And was there any sign back in the day, any sign of what was to come? Did you always think, I'm going to be a businessman, I want to work for myself, I'm into computers? What was happening in those early days, and were there any hints as to what you were going to do in the future?
No, I wouldn't say there were any. I mean, you always read these stories about, you know, these 10-year-old entrepreneur type kids. Well, that wasn't me. I remember I had a job once putting flyers in mailboxes after school. And, you know, like it paid about nothing. And after I'd been doing it for a while, I thought, you know, I think I'd rather have the time than the money. So, no, I didn't really, I wasn't like that at all. And I wasn't a hustler or any of that kind of stuff. When I was a young kid, you know, I played football and cricket. I was okay. I wasn't great. But when I was 14, my parents pushed me into taking up sailing because I don't know why. Anyway, and that really captured my imagination, and it was the first thing in my life that had really captured it, even though I was quite good at sport and I was quite good at school and all the other kind of stuff. But really, and that sort of took over my life really for the next 5 or 10 years, which wasn't quite the outcome they were hoping for.
The sailing part took up your life.
Yeah. Well, racing, obviously, small boats, you know, the sort of thing you guys have in the UK.
Yeah.
That type of stuff.
Is that where sort of the racing bug came and bit you, really? Is that when you were doing
racing?
Isn't that, did that, when did that develop into cars and your fascination with motor racing and motorsport?
Well, I never had much of an interest in cars when I was a kid. I remember, it's crazy how you remember some of the things. I was about 12 years old, and I thought, well, I won't be able to get a car license for 5 years. And when you're 12, 5 years seems so far down the line so I just thought I would forget about cars. But once I got a license and I started to, you know, drive, obviously it was fun. But the big thing about it was, and this is, you're going to laugh, when you race a boat, obviously the preparation work is basically the same as motor racing. You're always making stuff. Everything's built as light as possible. I used to say on these classes that didn't even have a minimum weight. So you're always working on the boat. You're always practicing hours rigging up, blah, blah, blah. And you could just get in the car and just go for a spin, which obviously was hell of a lot easier. So that made it quite attractive too, because, you know, you queue forward to the racing and it's completely different.
And Dickadata, so tell us how this came about. Founded circa 1978, you've taken an unconventional route to be a businessman in the sense that you've said in other interviews you weren't a fan of school, you didn't go to uni, there were no particular aspirations to start your own business and go down this road. So how did Dickadata come about? And when you started it and you started shipping out products and so on, did you ever imagine it would go on to the size that it became?
Well, no. Our original target was to sell 10 computers a month. You know, we do what we do. Our daily sales average in Australia now is about between, you know, 7,000 and 10,000 a day. I mean, that's just crazy difference. But I'd done this refrigeration mechanics course after I left high school, sort of at the behest of my parents. It was boring. I went overseas with a friend of mine for a while, and when I came back, my parents, like most parents, are always concerned and they're always pushing you to do things. So I took this job work. My father had this business making these metal plates that hold timber roof trusses together, and he had guys who used this system throughout Australia. So I took a job working in one of these plants in Adelaide, and I moved down there, and it was fun, really, to be honest. It was just basically, you know, manual work, and I'd been there about 6 months and they wanted me to stay there and manage it, but I went back and basically took over all the sort of strategy and operations of my father's business, and that's how we got into the computers, because in the old days, to make the trusses, you'd make a pattern and then you'd cut the pieces because all the bits of wood are different, and there's only about 20 or 30 trusses in the house, and every house is different, so it's a bit of a pest.
Mm.
So our consulting engineers started to muck around with these programmable calculators to work it out. And we decided to buy one to keep an eye on them because obviously consultants like that are super expensive. Anyway, I pretty quickly made better headway on the calculator than they were, so I took that over. And then we realised that we needed more powerful machines, and we tried to buy them in Australia, and we sort of struggled because the guys that were selling them were a bit hopeless. And we started buying these US magazines with these microcomputers in them, and, you know, it looked like it could do the job. And I went to America and bought four machines in about June or July of 78, and that's really how we started it. So I wrote all the software. We sold a fair few systems to our in-house guys, but it was obvious that these computers were going to be big, but obviously nothing like the way it's turned out.
How did you know what to do? I mean, you've got no formal qualifications at this point, but you're writing software, presumably self-taught. You seem to have a business brain at this stage. Where does it come from?
Yeah, well, who knows? I mean, look, one advantage of American products, especially in those days, is the documentation's terrific. So basically, if you can read, it's not that hard to figure it out because it's all written down. You know, like we used to work on all this assembly language stuff, and Intel had a book which just lists all the instructions and it's all there. So it's, you know, it's not really that difficult to figure it out. And I mean, business, well, I mean, I've always learned a lot from books and magazines. So, you know, pretty much everything I've learned has been that way, and there's a lot of stuff in there.
Wow.
And you pick up a lot of tips, and you know, you have an open mind on what to do, and you just look at the problem and work out how we're going to solve it. And I guess probably one of the main differences is that for most people, if they've got a problem, the solution will be to find someone else who knows how to solve it and get them to solve it. My approach usually tends to be to try to figure out how to solve it myself. Even if I then later get other guys involved in it, I like to have a pretty strong understanding of what's going on, because you can't manage people doing things that you don't know anything about. It doesn't work.
And you must have been quite early onto this whole computer boom that was coming, I suppose, in the 80s. When you look at companies like Lenovo, which I think was founded in 84, and you know, you've got Apple and all these out at Microsoft, all these big computer businesses coming online. Did you think this is a space that's going to blow up and I need to be on it? Or was it a case of right product, right place, right time, the rest is history?
Well, you know, Microsoft was a $6 million company when we started. That was their sales. And most of the... We started in things called microcomputers, and microcomputers predated the PC because the IBM PC didn't come out to whenever it came out. And the company that we represented in Australia didn't build a clone version of the IBM PC because they thought it was too late to get into that market. So... our relationship with them only lasted probably 4 or 5 years before they went broke, and then we had to find supply of other machines, mostly out of Taiwan, and we built up the business with that. And then we started to distribute Toshiba in Australia, which was about 85. And look, no plan at any stage, really. It's more like a case of, well, you're in it and you just got to do the best you can. And you just analyze the situation pretty much day by day. I mean, it was way too fast moving for any kind of long-term plan or any of that kind of thing.
And where is Dicker Data now? Like, are you still very much at the helm, steering the ship and in it day to day?
Well, I get the, you know, our sales reports and that every day, and I talk to our management people on the email every day. And I go to all the board meetings, and I still do all the strategy, and I do all the sort of the acquisition and all the sort of the big stuff, but I don't do the day-to-day stuff. And I'm not even really up to speed on technology either, to be honest. I mean, because, you know, I've got management guys over there that do all that stuff. And when you've got a company that size, there's no way you can do it yourself. It's not even close. So, you've got to have other people. And like, we've got sort of four key management areas, and three of those people have been working for me for 20 years. And the other guy's been there nearly 10. So they've been there a long time, and they know what to do, and they know how I like to work, and you know, it all works pretty well. I'm not a micromanager, you know. The way I basically work is to set the goals and sort of set a few parameters, and then just let them do it however they think's best, because that's the best way to get the outcome.
And it's clearly worked, and you've been incredibly successful with Dicker Data. But let's turn our attention to your new venture, or your current venture, Rodin Cars. Now, obviously, we've mentioned you have a passion for racing. You race in the Ferrari Challenge, of course, and you know, you're racing boats when you were young. Where did the idea for Rodin Cars come from then initially, and just tell us a bit about what the vision for it was when you first started it?
Well, you know, everyone who's interested in cars wants to build their own car. That goes way back. I had a kit car when I was about 20, so you know, I had a lot of experience of mucking around on the car, and again, reading all the books that you could buy and everything to try to understand the, you know, the mechanics and the dynamics of the whole thing. In about 83, I wrote, you know, suspension kinematic software, because we were sponsoring some guy in a Formula Pacific, so we could analyze the thing and all that kind of stuff. So goes back a long way. But the problem, of course, is money. You know, it's really expensive building cars, and it's much more expensive now than it was like 20 or 30 years ago as well, because, you know, the amount of equipment and the number of guys that you need now compared to what you could have got by within the 60s and 70s is much higher. The bar's been raised up by you know, just the whole way the industry's gone. So it's much more difficult to get into it, but I always wanted to do it. And really, the impediment was that I couldn't make the money fast enough. It took me a long time to make enough money to be able to do it.
But this is no small operation, is it? I mean, you're obviously based out in New Zealand with the factory, the plant, whatever we call it. But you've got the factory, and you also have your own test track. So why New Zealand? And tell us a bit about the facility.
Well, you couldn't do a project like this in Australia because the government hates cars in Australia. The police hate cars. And if you're a young guy and you're interested in cars, they're just going to hound you until you give up. There's no car culture in Australia anymore. It's been pretty much destroyed by the coppers and the government.
Really?
It's bad.
And how come? You mean you think you've got the Australian Grand Prix and things? You think there'd be some sort of thirst for motor racing?
Yeah, and we had all those motorbike guys, you know, Gardner doing all those dudes. But if you want to hoon around on the roads in Australia, they're going to screw you over big time.
Right.
You know, like it's the worst country in the world, really, for if you want to muck around with cars. It's terrible. And just multitudes of problems on it and just the whole thing. I mean, we got really low speed limits and they're really rigidly enforced.
Wow.
You know, so you can be nailed for being 3K over in a 60 zone in Australia. I'm talking 60 kilometres, you know, like I was nailed for doing 106 in a 100 zone once. You know, I mean, like it's just, and they're just obsessed with the road toll. Like, twice as many people suicide in Australia every year as are killed on the roads, but you wouldn't know it. And the amount of effort they put into it and the police presence, oh, God, it's absolutely appalling. They're everywhere.
God.
Like it's just
so thought, right, horrible. Up sticks, let's go to New Zealand where it's a little bit more chilled and start building a rival to a Formula One car.
Well, the other problem you've got in Australia, look, if you want to build cars, you've got to have a test track. I think that's obvious because without doing a huge amount of testing, you can't develop the car, and you've got to develop cars because that's just the way it is. You know, they're not going to just fly out of the shed first build and it's great. And the commercial tracks are so busy and so difficult that it's just not really viable. And, you know, the sort of testing that you do when you're manufacturing is like three laps just to see how something goes. You don't want to have to pack it up, trail it out, you know, the whole thing. So it's very difficult. I was born in Sydney, so you've got to be miles out of Sydney before you can get far enough out of Sydney to get real estate to even think about building a track. And then you'd have so many issues with the noise and all the other stuff. Hopelessly unviable, whereas in New Zealand, there's still a good car culture here. The cobbers have got a bit oppressive, but they're still not as aggressive as the ones in Australia.
Yeah.
And there's still a good car culture here. You know, when you take a drive on a Sunday here, you'll often see old and interesting cars on the highway and all that kind of stuff, and you just don't see much of that in Sydney. I mean, it's just gotten too big and it's too congested and it's screwed. So... You've got open area and you can build stuff.
I think if we've discovered one thing, it's that you do not want to drive in Australia.
No.
It's the one thing I've...
Avoid Australia at all costs. And you've got to be the only guy, surely, in New Zealand that has his own racetrack at his office. Is that fair to say?
No, not really, because, you know, Tony Quinn owns two tracks here. Okay, they're commercial tracks, but... You know, he can go out for a spin any day he likes. So, no, I'm not, there's always someone better, you know. One of those things you don't even want to worry about. There's always some guy who's got more money or more cars or more this or more that. So it's not really a competition. And, you know, we did it on the cheap anyway. The normal way to do it, like the way he did it, is, you know, get in a roading contractor and I'll bring in a huge team of guys and machinery and do it in 3 to 6 months and it'll cost a megabuck fortune. And when I started it here, I didn't really have that much money. I couldn't really do it that way, even if I wanted to. So what I did was buy machinery. And originally, I wanted to do a lot of the work myself. I did do a fair bit of, you know, work. But I hired a guy who used to work for a roading contractor who just lived in the local town. And then he and his father basically did all the work except for the laying of the tar. And, of course, it takes a bit longer because you've only got one or two guys, and Wynn's since died, so we've got one guy. But you've got your own equipment and you've got time, so you can do it the way you want to do it. Mm. And if you do something and you think, oh, it's not quite right, it's not a big hassle to redo it. Whereas when you do things with contractors, that kind of thing's not really an option. So you've got a lot more flexibility and you can do things much more exactly the way you want to do them.
Now, you have this amazing track in New Zealand. Tell us a bit more about the types of car then you are developing, because you've got a couple of different models, I suppose.
Well, if you want to go right back to the start of the project, in about 2000 and I'm not even sure what it was, it might have been 2002 or 4, whatever year the Commonwealth Games were on in Manchester.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Because my daughter was a professional cyclist and she was riding in them. And we were over in the UK, and we found this project that a guy had built back in '99. It was a GT1 car that Lola had basically built for him. And we sort of bought this project, so we had the car and some drawings and the body molds and all the other kind of stuff. And we thought, oh, well, we can build this. And it was going to be a road car, so you basically got a two-seat supercar. But the issue, of course, that you've got with any car is you've got to market the thing. And, you know, there's already a million two-seat supercars on the market. And in marketing, you've got to have an edge. And so what was the edge going to be? You know, I couldn't see one. And that's really when we decided to build a single-seat car, because the single-seat car is its own category. So then you can be out in front in your own category. And then we started to sort of think about the marketing side of that. And then, obviously, I've been following Formula One since the 70s. So then we thought, well, wait a minute, we can probably build a car quicker than a Formula One, and building a track car is a little bit easier than building a car for the road, because you won't have to worry about any of the rules. So that's really how it started. So, again, it wasn't really a grand plan, but the pieces sort of fall together as you give it some thought, and that's basically where it went. So then we thought, yeah, okay, that's what we'll do. And, you know, it ought to be reasonably viable, and then we'll just build road versions of it, and we're going to build an electric and petrol versions, because the electric cars are so easy to build that you'd be crazy not to. I'm not a big fan of the electric car, mainly because of the sound problem. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you still got to be realistic in the market.
And have you found that...
What's the history of it?
Have you found that the car is now quicker than a Formula One car?
Well, we don't have it running, to be honest. So we don't... all we have at the moment is looking at the data, you know, the specification. But the target weight, 605, and we've got most of the bits here. So I still feel pretty confident we should get to that number or pretty close to it. And the F1 guys are at 749, I think. So we've got a huge benefit in the weight there straight away. I mean, you know, that's 5-6 seconds a lap right there.
Wow. And when will we see it running?
It should be running by the end of the year, early next year. The engine will be the impediment, because we're building our own engine. And we had used a guy that I knew in the UK to do it originally, and it sort of got a little bit off the rails. So we gave it to Neil Brown, and they're going to finish it off. They should have it running, I hope, before Christmas, but maybe just after. And we're building a new facility down here, because we're going to bring all the engine manufacturing, including the castings and the cranks and everything, in-house in New Zealand early next year, so we can actually build the engines ourselves.
David, it feels like there should be a road and F1 team. Is this ever going to materialise?
Well, I'm not supposed to talk about it, you know.
Don't. You can't tease us like that. is it must cross your mind. Have you had people from Formula One sort of, you know, saying
no,
hi?
But I mean, you know that there are Formula One teams on the market.
Oh yes.
So, you know, you have to draw your own conclusions there, because I'm not supposed to talk about it. I don't think it's a massive secret, but I don't know whether there's anything possible there or not, but we are looking into it.
Brilliant.
That is very exciting.
Well, you've obviously taken the services of young Jamie Chadwick, who's involved with you in a partnership capacity and has spent some time at your racetrack. I think I'm right in saying she holds the record around your track. Jamie, someone we're very familiar with. How did that relationship start, and a great person to be aligned with?
Yeah, well, we got a PR agency in the UK, so they sort of put us under it. And I've always, you know, I've had a lot of women working for me. Like, I started Dicadata with my first wife, and, you know, I've always had a lot of faith in women, because I've always had good success working with them. And so that part was good. And she's actually good in the car. So it was pretty good, really. You know, like
now, Jamie is part of the Williams F1 team, isn't she? She's part of
Travelanum,
isn't she? Yeah.
And she got a podium. She got a podium.
She told me she'd never even driven one of the F1 cars, not even one of the old ones.
No,
and that's a travesty.
I mean, that's lame.
She had her first weekend in the Formula Regional series that she's racing in, and she bagged herself third already in the first outing. So she's had a pretty solid start to her new season, and obviously is the reigning W Series champion, so comes with some pedigree. So what plans have you got with Jamie moving forward?
Yeah, well, we'd like to put her into F3 International next year, and obviously move it up from there if we can.
It's
really up to her to get the pace and then move it up.
If all goes well, would you like to be affiliated with her and have her racing in Formula One?
Yeah, it'd be good if possible, because, I mean, from a marketing standpoint, it's a bonanza. And she's actually good in the car. So, you know, I think she's got the ability to actually do it, which is exciting, because there's only really, like, outside of drag racing in America, where there's plenty of women that go well, Michelle Mouton's the only woman who's ever really been any kind of force in motor racing, as far as I can think of, certainly in Europe. And she's definitely got the ability to do it. I feel sure of that. And yes, and that'd be good. I mean, look, I've always been a bit of an underdog supporter. You know, the big guys. Like, look, it's like Formula One now with Mercedes. It's boring because, you know, they've got more resources than anyone else. They've got the best car. They've got the best driver. Well, of course they're going to win all the races. Yeah. So what?
Yeah.
Not proven a thing, and it's as dull as dishwater. And look, I'm a massive fan of Ferrari, and I got a lot of Ferraris. But even I got a bit bored with it when Schumacher and that was just wiping them out in the same way, because it's dull, you know? It's not entertaining anymore.
Yeah, yeah. What's your favourite era of Formula One?
Well, I think the best era in Formula One was that relatively short period after the first turbo era, when they went back to the 3.5-litre engines, and they had a lot of, like, that was when, you know, more than 30 cars had turned up to a Grand Prix, and they'd have pre-qualifying or even, you know, a runoff for pre-qualifying and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't that expensive to build an F1 car. Like, with the facilities that we've got here, we could easily build an 89 F1. I had an 89 F1. So, you know, we could easily build a car like that completely from scratch. Because, you know, Ricardo's building the gearbox for the F-Zero, and it's a completely clean sheet design. So I think that was the best era, and up until sort of probably the mid-90s, when they sort of started to screw it up with, you know, that groove tyre stuff and all the other crap and the silly narrow track and all this whole, you know. Once they started to actively slow the cars down, I think they made a huge mistake. But that period, I think, was the best. If you look at, you sort of take everything into account, technically, drivers, the whole thing. I mean, there's been other eras with more exciting, I think more exciting driving stuff, like probably the 70s, but that's probably the era I like the best.
Yeah, yeah, it's that romance, isn't it, as well, of the olden eras. We had Freddie Hunt on the show not too long ago, and we were talking about, obviously, his father, James, and the battles with Lauda and so on. And those sorts of eras, although I think we look back with slight rose-tinted glasses sometimes about the racing, it did have a certain romance to it that I don't know that you get anymore.
Well, it's the teams are too efficient now. You know, the cars never break down. Like, you'd watch a race in the 70s and 80s, and sometimes you'd get five or six cars finish.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they were so rubbish that, you know, like, you know, the whole thing, I mean, yeah, it was just the excitement level was much higher. I mean, I don't know, even quite understand why they're fixated on all this overtaking stuff, because you don't need overtaking for exciting racing. Like, I don't know if you saw Jamie's race on the weekend, like in race one, but she spent basically the whole 30 minutes holding up three guys, and it was good. And you see piles of interesting stuff in F1 that haven't got anything to do with overtaking. I mean, if you want to see a lot of overtaking, we'll go to the speedway.
Mm.
I mean, you know, I don't think that's not what they need. And
yeah,
there's more overtaking in F2 and F3 anyway. I have to really wonder about this whole new car that they're going to have next year, where they're all going to be able to follow, and now it's all going to suddenly happen, because you get a lot more overtaking in F2 and F3 than you do in F1 anyway, and the F2 and F3 cars are all the same.
I suppose the overtaking is actually the boring part. That's when the actual fighting is over and someone's won, and then they just carry on their way. You want the fights to last longer, which might work with these new cars if they're able to get close to each other. But again, we'll have to wait and see. You yourself, though, are a racer, as we have briefly spoken about with the Ferrari Challenge. Tell us about that and how that's going, and what's it like driving those Ferrari GT cars?
Yeah, well, it's pretty good. I mean, Ferrari's a terrific company. In Asia-Pacific, Ferrari themselves run the whole series. So they look after all the cars, and they supply all the mechanics and all the engineers. And they do the hospitality, and they basically do everything. All you got to do is they organise the hotel and the whole thing. You just got to fly in. And it's great, really. They do a terrific job. It's a good car. And it's a good series. And, you know, it's not blighted by, like in Porsche Cup, where they have all these professional guys and all this other sort of stuff, which is just crap because, you know, I mean, I'm the oldest guy in it in Asia Pacific, but you still got some chance of getting some kind of outcome. And it's a good environment, it's a good atmosphere, and they're good cars. And, you know, really, it's pretty good.
What's your driving style? Are you a mentalist in the cockpit? Do you go crazy, foot flat to the floor, late braking, or are you more of a just take it as it comes, relax, Sunday drive?
No, I try to go as hard as I can. Like, I got a practice car in New Zealand. Well, actually, I had a 450. I bought a 458. It's a practice car here. I did about 1,000 laps here in the 458, and then I got a 488 practice car. And again, I've done, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 kilometres in that car. So, no, I take it real serious. We do all the, like, not last year, but the in the second season, we used to work on the setup of the car here, because I could never quite get it the way I wanted it. And we used to send a sheet to Ferrari before every round with the setup, and they'd just set the car up with the setups we'd done here. You have an engineer and a mechanic, and then last year I got a coach as well, and the engineer got a bit cranky about it because he said, well, you know, what am I doing? So last year I said, oh, well, okay, we'll do it your way. So we did it his way, which was okay, worked out pretty well. I did get the car working the way I wanted it to at the last race of last season. So, you know, the problem the challenge cars got is that basically there's just too much understeer in a challenge car. And you can try as hard as you like, but you're always fighting the understeer. You're just limited by how much speed you can carry into the turns by how much grip you got on the front. And I think the Evo cars are a fair bit better, but I haven't had it. I've only had one race in the Evo car, and that was in Bahrain, and Bahrain's a tyre killer, so we didn't really get a chance to get a good evaluation. And I don't have an Evo practice car down here, so I'm not really – I don't know much about the Evo. But, you know, it's a really good series, and they're really good race cars as well. And it's amazing considering how close they are to the road car.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic stuff. And now, living in Dubai, you might be aware of, I'm sure you are aware of this already, you actually have one of the world's great driving roads an hour down the road from you or so in Ras Al Khaimah. Have you done the mountain road there in Ras Al Khaimah in one of your supercars?
No, of course not.
Oh, you should. We went there with a guy called JWW, who I don't know if he's been to your track out in New Zealand. I think one of the YouTubers.
I've seen his videos on YouTube, though.
So we went out with him to Ras Al Khaimah and took a McLaren and a Ferrari up that road for 35 kilometres. It was absolutely incredible. It's an amazing driving road. I'd highly recommend it. But listen,
I should.
In terms of business, there are many entrepreneurs and businessmen around the world who have theories or write books about what people should do to be successful, from starting a day at 5 a.m. to healthy eating, working out, meditating, doing things 10 times better than anyone else in your niche. What advice could you give to someone about starting a scalable and sustainable business now? Like, what would you tell people if they were just starting out on their own business ventures?
Well, I think the main thing for success is a commitment bordering on obsession. That's really what you need, because look, when I got into the business, I'd been racing these boats for 10 years. And to be honest, I was burnt out. I was sick of it. I used to go quite well. I won a lot of club championships. I didn't win anything above that, but I was quick and I was good, but I was burnt out and I was tired of busting my ass and I had no money. It was a bit crap, you know. And once I got into business, the biggest difference between business and sport is that in sport, if you're not winning, you're basically screwed, because that's the way sport works. Whereas in business, it isn't like that. You know, it's not sort of graded out in such an easily visible way. So you can be very successful in business and you don't necessarily have to be that good. You just have to perform, and, you know, there's so many categories and so many opportunities. It's just a completely different world, and it's a much more suitable world, because sport's cruel. If you're not winning, then you're losing.
Yeah.
And you don't have that issue in business. So, yeah, I found that invigorating.
Yeah, and particularly in Formula One. I mean, we've interviewed a few guys on here who have been in Formula One, like Brendan Hartley, who didn't win and didn't necessarily perform as high as they would have liked to, and got absolutely annihilated by the media, broadcasters, fans, and before you know it, you're chucked out of the team and you're having to find a new way to make a living. But it is a brutal world indeed. Question for you is, as you were growing up through your business career, did you have, well, actually, business and racing, it could be either. Did you have an idol or someone you aspired to, or was there a hero or anyone that really mentored you through the years?
I've never really had a mentor, because I'm a bit too headstrong for the mentor thing, especially when I was younger. Like, I was obsessed with doing it my way. Like, at my funeral, I'm going to have Frank Sinatra singing my way.
Well, it's worked all right.
That's how I feel about it. And when I was younger, I just wasn't mature enough to really understand that getting the outcome's more important in the final upshoot than sort of the way you got the outcome. But unfortunately, that's still very important to me. And so it's not just winning. It's winning in a certain way that was important. And really, I guess even in business, it's the way you do things that are just about as important as the outcome. Like at Dicker Data, you know, we use different ways of operating and we have different philosophies, and that kind of thing's important to me. And, like, you know, we did a public float that was done in a way that all the advisors said you couldn't do it that way, but we did it. And then we bought this company that was two or three times bigger than our company, and we did it on 100% debt. Now, you guys mightn't be sort of completely up to speed on all that kind of stuff, but that's basically unheard of. You know, when we wanted to do this thing, they said, oh, well, you'll have to do 40% equity of your company to do it. And I said, no way I'm going to do that, because we wanted to do the equity later. So we bought this company with 100% debt, and it was really tight, but we managed it. And then we floated shares away later on to pay down the debt. It cost, we bought it for 50-odd million, and that was a massive improvement, you know, in the equity base by doing it. Of course, it was tough, but, you know, so they're the kind of things that help you out by having slightly better strategies. And in the business, like, we project our sales a year ahead. So our time horizon is basically 12 months, and we project that for each month. So for each individual month, we have a target of what we want to do, because we've been in this business for so long that we understand it exceptionally well. And by doing that, we have, everyone's got a clear picture of what they need to do. Whereas if you're in a business and the target is, well, let's sell as much as we can, how does that work? I mean, what's as much as we can? It's like, you know, it'd be like a guy in a motor race. It'd be like the Mercedes guy saying, well, look, shit, we got to win by as much as we can.
Yeah.
And they'd be saying, well, what's that mean? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
when you've got a target, and then you just be satisfied that you make the number.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is just a better way of doing things than this sort of idea of, well, we just got to get as much as we can. It doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. And also trusting your own instincts, I think. I mean, it sounds like you're a character who dances to his own tune. You know, you're not trying to emulate somebody or follow someone else's path or necessarily, you know, take someone else's guidance. You're doing what you feel is right. And by all accounts, it's paid off.
Well, I try to analyze the situation rationally, and then usually the solution's pretty obvious,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Try to take the emotion out of it, and especially, obviously, you deal with people and you work with people that you wouldn't socialize with necessarily, and, you know, like vendors especially, and you just learn to deal with all that kind of stuff and keep the emotion out of it, because as soon as the emotion comes into any of these things, you're going to make bad decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. If you could go back in time, is there anything you'd change about the way you did business or about yourself?
Well, I would have probably tried to avoid getting divorced.
That's probably because of the business, yeah, wasn't it?
My first wife was a good person. It was really my fault. And we still get on well. So, you know, and to be honest, like, I often wonder how it amazes me how these professional sportsmen in their 20s can deal with it all, because when I was in my 20s, I'm sure I wouldn't have been able to deal with any of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then I don't know if I'd want to go back again, because it's so hard to get an outcome. But I'm not sure I'd want to take the risk of having to start again, because it's really tough. You know, like, I consider myself to be exceptionally fortunate to the position I'm in, because my ex-wife left our business in the start of 2004, and we tried to sell it for $10 million a year or two earlier. So, you know, my net worth was like about $5 million. Now, okay, most people would think, oh, well, yeah, this is great. But really, I'd already been in the business since 78. So whatever, what's that, 26 years. And I had $5 million. I mean, that wasn't very impressive. And, you know, in the 16 years since then, obviously the position's improved out of sight. And, you know, that's a very satisfying outcome, because I'm not one to push people out of the way to take charge. So I let Fiona sort of pretty much run it. I mean, I set the strategies and we talked about everything, but she basically operated it. And after we got divorced in 96, so even though we'd kept working together, obviously there's a few issues there. And it was pretty satisfying to be able to pick it up and get an outcome out of it from there. So,
What's next? What's the next big venture? Is there one, or is it just to carry on doing what you're doing?
Grave beckons.
That's the spirit.
Not until you're in Formula One, please.
Yeah, but look, I'm 67 years old. I should have retired. I mean, God almighty, we would have been in our 30s and we were making pretty good money. And I can remember Fiona's parents not being able to understand why we didn't just retire. I mean,
you get bored,
my granny, yeah, you would, but sometimes it'd be nice to be able to kick back a little bit. But my grandfather died at my father's work, and that's probably how I'd like to go, you know.
From what you said, I just can't see you retiring somehow. I think the Dicker empire is going to continue, hopefully till we see you in a certain type of single-seater racing in the future. Listen, David, we won't keep you for too much longer. We've got three final questions which we ask all of our guests. Harry, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah. So first one, what's got you excited at the moment?
Well, I'm excited about what we're doing, obviously, but that's a sort of a whole long-term thing. But I bought a car on a whim yesterday morning. That was exciting.
What was it?
It's I'm not even sure what the year model is, but a Ferrari 308 GT4.
Wow.
That's so cool. I had a 308 GTB in the 80s, and I've always liked that car, and I've got a lot of the modern Ferraris, and they're great, but the problem you've got is that the performance is so stupendous that it's very difficult to use. And it's going to be nice to just see what the old carburetor, and obviously the first thing we'll do is put a tubey on it, and that'll be a bit of fun. You'll be able to actually rev the engine out without worrying about going too fast.
That's very cool, very cool. If not doing what you're doing now, what would you be doing had this never happened?
I haven't got any idea. When I was in fifth year, I was 17. I wanted to leave school and become a sailmaker because we had a sailmaker who made all our sails, and I wanted to apprentice to him, and my parents wouldn't let me. So if I'd have done that, things would have taken a completely different turn. But I often wonder what I'd do if I had to start from scratch, and to be honest, I haven't got any idea, but I'm sure I'd think of something.
Yeah.
That's amazing what could have been. Final question for you, though. What are you scared of?
Well, I don't like lizards and snakes.
No. And Aussies, nice. Full of them.
Yeah, I know. That's one of the things that's good about New Zealand. There are no reptiles here.
Yeah.
Not like Australia. I don't want to get anywhere near any kind of big creepy crawlies or anything like that.
Well, when I was a kid, the guys over the road had a house in a sort of a bush setting, and there used to be this blue-tongued lizard that had sort of sun on this little step around a corner, and you'd walk around this corner and scare the shit out of you.
I must admit, I'm not a fan of lizards or snakes or anything of that variety. And Australia, you can keep your nasty big bugs.
Actually, David, one last question just before we let you go back to the rest of your day. Rodin, where'd the name come from?
Well, most guys are egomaniacs, so they want to they want the car to have their own name. I'm not really an egomaniac, and I don't find my name an attractive sounding set of syllables. So I think that was never even a question. And we only called it Dicker Data because I'm a stupid father. He thought that was a great idea. I sure didn't. But so after you don't use your own name, the next thing is some stupid animal thing, which I also thought was very lame. So, you know, that statue, the Thinker? Yeah, well, that was done by Rodin. Well, it's Rodin, really, okay. But, you know, we're English-speaking, so we call it Rodin. And so that statue is sort of our logo, and the car epitomises human thought. So that's the basis behind the name.
Oh, that statue. This is terrible. I'm ashamed to admit it. I had to Google that. And now I know the statue that you're talking about.
The Thinker. Was that a quick Google search of the Thinker?
Yeah, basically. And he is thinking. He is sat there thinking. Yeah.
No, well, my first wife was the only subject she passed in high school was art. So we thought about using it on a like I spent 10 years trying to build my own computer back in the 80s, so you know, it does have a long pedigree, but I liked it, so I thought I'd use it again.
Actually, I've got one more for you. Sorry, we keep saying we're going to stop, and then we keep asking you one more thing. One more thing. Outside of racing, being a businessman, building cars, what's your talent? What have you got that no one knows about necessarily? What have you got another talent outside of all those things?
Probably not. I don't know. I mean, I've still got a boat. I mean, I bought a boat in Australia, but I haven't even seen it for 4 or 5 years. So I used to do a bit of skiing. Used to be able to ski outside of the front door of my house in Italy, but they took the lift down last year. But no, not really. Look, I'm not that exciting. And when I get involved in things, I like to really get on it. Like I in the late 80s and early 90s, my wife thought it'd be a good idea for our company to bowl in a league, you know, 10-pin bowling. Mm-hmm. So we started to bowl it. I did a little bit of it when I was a kid and I used to enjoy it. But anyway, I started to practice a lot and bowl in leagues and tournaments and all that kind of stuff. And I was okay, not too bad. I'd wrecked my shoulder skiing, unfortunately, back in the 80s, and that always made it a bit difficult. But I got so obsessed with the practice that we actually put our own lane in at the factory. So we actually had our own bowling lane in-house, and it was a proper lane with a, you know, a Brunswick A2 and the whole thing, exactly the same. It was only one lane, but exactly the same. And I used to drill my own balls because drilling the balls is very scientific. You know, bowling balls are not just round bits of plastic. When you get up to sort of the pro level, the drilling and the construction of the balls and the finish of the surfaces and that is massively complex and scientific. And it was a lot of fun, really, you know.
God, built your own alley.
So I find it pretty easy to get obsessed with almost anything if I just happen to get into it.
Yeah. And but does that obsession, apart from the obvious with your businesses, does that obsession fade? Are you one of those people that gets totally into something and then after 6 months thinks, on to the next thing, I'm bored?
Well, I probably last about maybe 5 or 10 years. Like, you know, I bowled for ages and ages. We moved, I don't know, I think I started to bowl in about 91 or 92. And we moved from the factory that we had the bowling lane in 99. So I didn't really sort of bowl a real lot after that because we couldn't move it and blah, blah, blah. So that was a fair period. I spent 10 years racing the boats. I went from 14 to 24. So, you know, I've got a fair bit of stickability.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating stuff. Listen, we must let you go, but it's been a pleasure to talk to you. We obviously wish you all the best for Rodin. Your relationship with Jamie, obviously, we hope that goes from strength to strength. And if you find yourself on our shores when lockdown is all out the way, we'd love to take you for a bite to eat and chat some more.
Yeah, well, I'll keep you posted because I may have to make a trip to the UK imminently.
Good. Well, let us know if you do.
And we're booking that flight to New Zealand as soon as we can.
100%.
Yeah, well, you're welcome to come down here. You know, we'll put you in a couple of interesting cars and, you know, it's great, really.
Yes. We've got to do it, Harry. It's got to be done. There's a new video coming. Brilliant. Well, David, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast and wish you all the best in the future. Let's definitely keep in touch.
Yeah, thanks very much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter @Motormouth_, Instagram @Motormouth_official, and on Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile and interact with others, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. it. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.